You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the race for space started as a contest for countries, but in the last 20 years, private businesses have taken center stage. Look behind the scenes of the companies racing for orbit and beyond with the author of the new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about mothers.
Many of us are grateful for everything our mothers taught us. For Jana Rose Schleiss, she's thankful that her mother taught her how to be beautiful.
I learned how to be a woman from my mom. What I mean is, I learned how to express my femininity from her. This isn't unique to me. For a lot of people, our mother is our first beauty standard. We grow up thinking she's the prettiest woman in the world. For girls, at some point in our lives, we gotta decide what kind of woman we wanna be and how we present that to the world. Through a million minuscule choices, we express ourselves and our femininity. The older I get, the more I realize I've been modeling myself off mom in subtle and not so subtle ways. My mother was a teacher. She also had five kids and a dairy farm to help run. When we were younger, she didn't have time for frivolous beauty trends or anything that wasn't practical. My three sisters and I, however, wanted everything new and impractical the early aughts could offer. Blue eyeshadow, the infamous Rachel haircut, and oh my gosh, flip-flops. When my mother goes out, her routine is this: makeup, mascara, a bit of eyeliner, lipstick, hair, a few curls applied to her cropped locks, then brush back. Accessories. She keeps her most worn jewelry in a shot glass in the kitchen cupboard. I don't know how this became the norm. It drives my father, who bought much of it, crazy. She dumps the glass out, chooses a pair of small hooped earrings, and puts the many gold rings she wears on her hands. She's ready. I'm 30 now, and I've had plenty of time to experiment with my femininity. For style, there was the mismatched floral print phase, the crop tops and platforms phase, and this was all just during college. My hair journey has been similarly chaotic. For the few years I was a wannabe hippie, I didn't cut or even brush my hair. I could tell it drove my mother nuts, but she had a light, perhaps sometimes passive-aggressive touch. I'd receive gift cards for haircuts and the quick aside of, run a comb through your hair and then we'll go. But overall, she knew I needed to work through this stuff on my own. I've been dyeing my naturally brunette hair red for 10 years. This vibrant hair has become my brand, if you will. A friend recently asked why I chose this color. I told the story of how it initially happened. I got a horrid haircut before studying abroad. I bought a box of dye and tried to take control of the situation. To my 20-year-old self, this made sense. But looking back, it's obvious why red is the ideal beauty standard to me. For as long as I can remember, my mom's hair has been dyed shades of auburn. By the way she carries herself, my mother has taught me to never be ashamed of my body. She's always seemed so comfortable in hers. Something I'm very thankful for in a world that sends women messages like, you're too fat, you're too tall, you're too loud, you're too assertive, you're too independent, and the choices you've made are wrong. When I was younger, my mom let me be whatever I needed to be. All through puberty and the many confusing chapters after, I could always come to mom. She'd take me and my questions about my body and beauty seriously. I have nieces now, and I know they're watching, taking in the variety of women around them. They giggle at my armpit fuzz, want to touch my nose ring. They'll grow into their femininity one day too, play around with it and try different things. I'm so grateful they have many strong and beautiful women in their lives to take cues from. When I go out, my routine is this: makeup, mascara, brows, lipstick, hair, a few curls, brush back, accessories. From a jewelry box, I choose a variety of cheap gold rings and a pair of earrings. I know I'm ready. I know I'm beautiful because of mom.
Jana Rose Schleiss brought us that story on her beautiful mother. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Space used to be considered the fictional final frontier, science fiction explorers going where no one had gone before. Then real-life countries started to make space travel a reality. People in orbit, then on the moon, probes to our nearest planetary neighbors and beyond, powered by national space agencies and big-name contractors. But then things changed. Our next guest says there was a major turning point when space suddenly became a new open field for private industry and lots of companies who've gotten in on the act. That, he says, is the greatest technology story of our time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow the latest news on space, rockets, and what's going on in Earth's orbit? Have you been following the trials and tribulations of SpaceX, Blue Origin, or the smaller rocket and space commerce startups out there? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Ashley Vance is a feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek and the host of the Bloomberg show Hello World, which focuses on inventors and scientists. His books include Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the quest for a fantastic future. His newest book is called When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think when people think of, you know, newer companies getting into the space business, they might think of SpaceX and Elon Musk. Your book highlights there is a lot going on beneath that surface. Can you talk about the variety of players in this rising industry?
Yeah, I mean, SpaceX definitely, I argue in the book, was this inciting incident for what has come since. I don't think most people are aware, which is why I wanted to write this thing, that there are dozens of rocket startups all around the world. There are hundreds of satellite startups all around the world. There are entire nations that are becoming spacefaring nations for the first time. And we're in a bit of a race right now among all these commercial companies to put up many thousands of times more satellites around the Earth than have ever existed before.
What led to the transition between, like I said, you know, a space program is your space agency and some really big name contractors in the aerospace industry, to the idea that lots more players can come in and, you know, maybe with some government support and contracts, of course, and try lots of smaller experimental things?
A lot of it was timing and then also a mentality shift. I think we reached a point where there had been huge advances in materials, huge, huge advances in electronics that helped bring the cost of these rockets down, the cost of satellites down, that made them better, and that also made it feasible for smaller teams to try and do these things as opposed to nation states. And then I think it was just this awakening. Space, it seems futuristic and advanced and all that, but it had been stuck for about 60 years. The underlying technology really had not changed much. And so you suddenly had a group of people who believed they could have a clean slate and do something new.
You share a lot of the personalities behind this as well as the technology. And one of the most interesting ones I thought was this chance meeting, an argument actually at a bar between a bunch of self-proclaimed space hippies and then a military, an Air Force general who had worked on the Strategic Defense Initiative for Star Wars and black operations and things like that. And this was a pivotal moment. Can you share a little of that story?
Yeah, this general's name is Pete Warden. He's one of my favorite people and characters in the book. He was an astrophysicist by training. He was in the Air Force, but through his decades in the military and the government, he'd always been this iconoclastic figure who really wanted to do space differently. And through a series of events, he ended up inheriting, becoming the director of NASA Ames, which is Silicon Valley's NASA center. And he took this as an opportunity to not just change NASA, but space overall. And there was this group of youngsters that he'd met at some of these space conferences. They were space hippies. They were idealistic. They also wanted to do different things in space. And so he flooded NASA Ames with all these 20-somethings. And, you know, NASA had this allergic reaction to this idea they could do things cheaper and better, but many of these people succeeded, and they've started a lot of these commercial space companies that we have today.
And we might see some of the higher profile, you know, rocket launches, like the most recent one from SpaceX. But it seems like a big part of the story is this explosion, I guess, not so dramatic as that one, but a huge rise in the number of satellites up in Earth's lower orbit. Can you talk about the scale of the growth in our satellites?
I don't think people are aware of this, but they should be, which is why I wrote the book. But from about 1960 to 2020, we had a sum total of 2,500 satellites in low Earth orbit. And just in the last 3 years, that number has gone up to 8,000. It's going to double next year. It's going to reach 100,000 satellites within the next decade and possibly keep growing from there. And I argue in the book, what we're doing is building what I describe as a computing shell around the Earth. This is the next stage of our technological advancement and infrastructure. And it just happens to be taking place over our heads, as opposed to doing things like laying fiber optic cables under the ground here on Earth.
We're talking to Ashley Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? What hopes or fears do you have about the commercialization of space? What role should governments, say the U.S. government or international organizations, have in regulating it? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the commercialization of space with Ashley Vance. His new book is When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Superior. Mike, hi.
Hi. I've traveled 49 states and always looking for the darkest experiences, from the loneliest road in Nevada to the southern Alaska. And I found that the best dark sky viewing I've ever seen in my life is in the northern, far northern tip of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan called Brockway Mountain. And that summer sky there is probably as close to it as any place could be. And it pains me because one night I was up there and I saw what I would call a string of pearls. And I think it was a recent Elon Musk launch of satellites. And it was like six satellites all in a row. And it just pains me to be thinking that those dark skies are going to be completely gone. So if anybody from Wisconsin or the Midwest hears this and wants to see it before it does fade, Mount Brockway up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan is probably the best dark sky that I've seen in any of the 49 states.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Mike, not the only one concerned, Ashley, about the changing vision of our night sky because of artificial satellites. I know there's some scientific concern from astronomers as well. Are we going to see enough satellites up there that it's really going to spoil our view?
Yeah, those were almost certainly the SpaceX satellites he was talking about for their Starlink internet system. And this is why I wrote the book now. Nobody's paying attention to this stuff. I mean, my book is optimistic overall because these things are going to do some very important functions for us. But to be honest, you can just expect more and more of that. This is going to be a regular occurrence. Astronomers are concerned. Other people are concerned. I was sort of shocked that astronomers voiced these concerns so late because we all knew what SpaceX was going to do. There is some inevitability to all this now.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And on a related note, Ashley, it's not just looking crowded from here on Earth. There are more and more satellites from governments and militaries and startups, so many that there's another startup that's kind of acting as an air traffic controller?
That's right. Yeah, there's a company called Leo Labs. And obviously, we've had government systems for tracking objects in space. This company has built a new type of antenna. They're building a network of antennas around the world. They can see pretty much every object in space down to a couple of centimeters, so even debris from things. But this is the stage we're at. It's great that this company exists. It's also a small 50-person startup that is now in charge of leading the way on managing all of this. And this is, again, the reality people need to be aware of.
Is there a thought that some more organized body is going to come in and start regulating this? I mean, I just try to picture like, okay, we've got all these airplanes in the sky, and then some guy started a business to help make sure they don't crash into each other. It doesn't sound like an ideal system to me.
It's in everyone's best interest, obviously, that this works, especially the satellite companies, because if you have a crash, you have every chance of creating this kind of cascading debris field. And the federal regulators are looking over this. I think they are having trouble keeping up with the pace that this industry is going. They're used to this 60, 70 year old pace that's flipped very quickly. And so I'm not, you know, it's just not at all clear how this is going to play out. But again, for these companies, it's essential that they figure this out. And so they want all of this to work.
Talking to Ashley Vance about his new book, When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Ashley, so much of your book is you on the ground, checking out these companies as they succeed or fail at their various experiments. Which companies struck you as ones that, you know, even if they're not household names right now, maybe they should be?
Well, there's a company called Rocket Lab, which is based in New Zealand and was founded by this guy named Peter Beck. And it's an incredible story. He never even went to college. He worked as an apprentice at a dishwasher manufacturer and was building rockets in a shed behind his house. He was making his own propellants. He ended up creating a rocket and then another one, and now a very large company that's valued at several billion dollars and is the second coming of SpaceX. He did all this in New Zealand, which has no aerospace history. He's set pretty much every first you can have for the Southern Hemisphere in terms of aerospace. And just in it's a story that I think points to how far we have come from this being something pursued just by nation states, just by billionaires, that this driven individual and his team were able to pull this off.
Another individual key to another one of these companies you talk about in the book is a Ukrainian named Max Polyakov. I hope I'm saying his name right. Can you share about his story and the company he helped created and ultimately had to leave?
Max is maybe the tragedy in the book. He was an OBGYN by training. Shifted his career in Ukraine to become this multimillionaire software magnate. His parents both worked on the Soviet space program. And a company in Texas that was building a rocket went bankrupt called Firefly, and Max bought it. He put $250 million into this company. Max is an incredibly eccentric, driven, quite chaotic individual, and he ends up being thrown out of his company by the U.S. government. You could check out the book to sort of see how this interplays with the war in Ukraine. But yes, I mean, this is the drama that's taking place in this industry as politics and commerce and all of these new realities collide.
Speaking of realities, this may feel, you know, a way away from us here in Wisconsin, startup companies around the world, stuff happening up in low Earth orbit. How are we going to be feeling the impact of this expansion in the satellites and the things they're doing in the next few years?
The most immediate things that these thousands of satellites are doing are the space internet that we talked about. And so people probably listening have a number of them probably have Starlink, where you get high speed internet in a place you previously could not be reached by high speed internet. That same story is true for 3.5 billion people around the world. And then there's a huge class of imaging satellites, which are, as opposed to images from space being rare and very expensive, we are now flooded with millions upon millions of images that capture everything happening, literally everything happening on Earth every day. A company called Planet Labs is the leader in this. And so we're getting this picture of the, I call it like the sum total of human activity on Earth. And in the Midwest in particular, farmers are using these satellites to check on the health of their crops. They can see how much chlorophyll is in the crops and the ideal time to harvest them and the health of their fields.
One thing that struck me just from you being on the ground at so many of these sites, and you write about this, we might picture, you know, a rocket lab, a launch facility as this like amazing piece of set design for the most elaborate science fiction movie. And tell us about the reality. What do these places really look like?
Some of the startups are pretty fancy. Rocket Lab's got some fancy things, but the actual launch sites themselves are crazy. they tend to be near the equator. The Earth actually spins faster at the equator. It gives these rockets some extra boost, and that they also tend to be by water, so they don't blow up and hurt things and people. And so I went to India, I went to French Guiana, I went to Svalbard, which is another extreme at sort of the farthest north on our planet, and this is where much of the space infrastructure is. It's quite dated. A lot of this was built in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and it's remote and quite poor. It was just such the opposite of what I was expecting going into reporting on space.
In just our last half minute, this is a business that changes quickly. What is the next big space story you have your eye on?
Well, I really think it's just watching to see if the business case behind all of this stuff arrives. We've pumped $280 billion into this industry. There seems to be a lot of promise, but now is the real test to see just how far this goes and which ones of my characters survive into the next chapter.
Ashley, we'll leave it there. Thanks for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
That's Ashley Vance, a feature writer at Bloomberg Businessweek, host of the travel show Hello World. We talked to him today about his new book. It's called When the Heavens Went on Sale, The Misfits and Geniuses Racing to Put Space Within Reach. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, religion in the United States has changed a lot in recent years, in some ways under the radar. That could all determine the outcome of the 2024 elections. Connect the dots from the pews to the polls. And a new history puts Native Americans at the center of the United States story. We'll meet the author of the new book, The Rediscovery of America. As always, you can join the conversation on the air or email ideas@WPR.org. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, with graduation season underway across Wisconsin, we'll get a look at the state's job market, find out what new high school and college grads can expect as they look for work. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a CNN town hall featuring former President Donald Trump raised questions about the right way to cover candidates and misinformation as the presidential campaign kicks off. Our guest says Trump is worth covering, but not like that. First, it's graduation season across Wisconsin, and this year's graduates are the first to have spent the majority of the last 4 years getting their education while navigating a pandemic. There's some good news for new grads in last month's jobs report from the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. Unemployment for 20 to 24-year-olds fell to the lowest it's been since 1969 here in Wisconsin. On the other hand, some recent high-profile layoffs have added a layer of uncertainty. One survey of college seniors found that nearly all of them are considering alternative employment options, taking a job outside their major, entering into the gig economy, or going on to graduate school. Whether coming out of high school or college, what can new graduates expect here in Wisconsin? We're taking a look at the job market around the state and what people entering the workforce can expect as they launch their careers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a recent graduate or about to graduate, how's your job search going? Are you finding opportunities in your field of study? Or if you're a parent of a new grad, what are you seeing them looking at? Are you hiring people? Are you looking to hire new graduates? Are you having trouble hiring from the current pool out there? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve Deller is a UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and Professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
But overall, what does the job market look like right now in Wisconsin compared to, say, the last few years of the pandemic?
Well, I think if you go back a year ago and compare to a year ago, it's softening a little bit. It's still really pretty strong. When you look at unemployment rates and you look at the number of job openings and whatnot, the economy is still doing quite well, but not as well as it was about a year ago. So essentially what we're seeing is the rising interest rates that the Federal Reserve has been putting into place. We're starting to see it tap down the economy. So are we in a recession? No, not yet. Are we going to go into one? Probably. Will it be a mild recession? Probably. It could be unique in the sense that we are in a formal recession, but the unemployment rate still stays fairly low.
Let's look at the prospects now for those new graduates. Let's start with college grads because they're mostly graduated by this point. What does the job market look like for them right now?
Well, it depends on what kind of occupation that they want to go into. There are certain degrees that the choice of employment is a little bit more limited in terms of what they can do. But there are certain majors like the healthcare sector that is quite robust. The education field, the number of teachers, the teacher shortages. So if you've got a degree in education, a degree in healthcare, even in business still, your job prospect is quite well. Engineering, Wisconsin, we have a shortage of engineers. So if you're coming out with an engineering degree, it looks very, very good. But there are other degrees that maybe it might be a little bit tighter.
Now, say somebody's getting ready to get out of high school right about now. And again, this covers a wide variety of jobs. But big picture, what are prospects looking like?
It depends on what part of the state you're in. And there are some parts of the state that are still doing quite well. Thank you very much. But there are other parts of the state that, selection might be a little bit tougher. It might be that your first job is not your ideal job, but there are jobs out there, particularly if you're willing to commute a little bit. What we're finding over time is that in Wisconsin, and indeed across the Midwest, is folks are willing to commute greater distances for employment. So if you're flexible, I think you won't have a problem finding a job. May not be your ideal job, but you won't have a problem finding a job.
What are some of the hot spots, given that you say that there's some variation across the state there?
Madison is still doing exceptionally well, the Madison area. You go up into the St. Croix area, that's doing very well. The Appleton area is doing very well. Some of the suburbs around Milwaukee are doing very well. So there are parts that are doing well. As I go around the state working with communities, I am still impressed by the number of businesses that have help wanted signs out. So it is, the jobs are there. But again, it may not be your optimal first job out of school, but employment opportunities are there.
Now, this was pre-COVID, but doing site visits in some smaller communities around the state, I've run into people who say, kids who say, I'd love to stay in my hometown. The jobs available after I graduate high school are exactly the same jobs I can get as a high school student. There's not much to keep me here employment-wise. Do we have a lot of communities in that position around the state?
Yes, there is. But again, this is where this notion of commuting is coming into play. Mm-hmm. People are starting to say, look, I want to live in this community, but the job opportunities are, 40 miles that way. And what we're finding is that people are willing to commute that distance. So also a lot of it has to do with kind of the housing market. We're finding that a lot of communities across Wisconsin kind of have come to being worried about the housing market because of labor shortages. People want to move in, take the jobs, but there's no housing. So there's a lot of convoluted, when you start getting, sub-state, looking at individual communities and individual regions, there's a lot of confounding issues.
Now, with a fairly tight labor market, are we seeing kids who maybe 5-10 years ago would have said, I'm going to come out of high school, get a couple years of technical college under my belt, then start my real job search? Are they skipping that step, going right into jobs?
I think that they are. And I also think that you'll see a number of state agencies, for example, are, jobs that had required a bachelor's degree, a college degree, are saying, maybe this job doesn't need that. And they're dropping it down to a high school with experience. And for a lot of occupations, a lot of jobs, that may make perfect sense. So I do think you see a number of folks, young folks that are thinking, maybe I'll put off that going to technical college. Maybe I'll put off going to the university or to college. I'll put that off and get a job and, you know, save some money for college. A lot of students are really looking at student debt, and they're really thinking about how can they continue their education without going up to their eyeballs in debt.
Talking to Wisconsin economist Steve Deller about job prospects, for this year's season of graduates, college and high school. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you or your family right now? If you're on the market at any level, new graduate or beyond, what are you seeing when it comes to job opportunities? Are you commuting a long way to have the job you want but live in the place you want? And they're not the same thing. And if you're hiring people, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve, what are you watching for now over this next year or so with, as you say, that prospective recession on the horizon? It doesn't sound like you think the bottom is suddenly going to fall out of the employment market here.
No, I don't. And one of the reasons I think this is because there's a lot of businesses that had really struggled with hiring people. And when they finally do get people hired, they're hesitant to let them go. So I think what we're seeing is kind of a decline in the number of new job openings, but yet the rate of people being let go is actually pretty stable. You hear about some of the big companies like Meta, Facebook, Google, Amazon. You know, they're really big companies that are laying off in the thousands of people. But, you know, they're kind of a unique situation because they overhired coming out of COVID. But your typical business, your typical Main Street business is probably going to want to try to hang out of their workers for as long as they possibly can. And if it's a mild recession, they may come out the other side looking good.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Sandra is with us in Williams Bay. Sandra, hi.
Hi. So my interest is I have a nonprofit, and we offer college scholarships. And this year we were in a situation where we couldn't award a scholarship because the person that we'd like to award it to was not going to college. I was taking a year off to work. So I think that there's probably lots of people in that situation where they have college scholarships to give, but they're taking time off, so we don't know how to really deal with that situation.
Interesting, Sandra. Good luck sorting that out. And Steve, at least one data point there of a student who said, yeah, let's at least hold off on college and take a year to work first.
That's right. Particularly when you're looking at the low unemployment rates right now, you're looking at wages bidding up, and folks are, you know, looking at that price tag of a college education, and they're saying, you know, let's just wait. And I think we're going to be seeing more of that.
Sandra, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Steve Deller, Community Economic Development Specialist and Professor of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, with us today to look at the job market for recent high school and college graduates. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your own experiences. What was the job market like when you graduated? What was your first job out of school at whatever level? How long did that last? And recent and soon-to-be graduates or families thereof, what are you finding with that initial job search? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Steve Deller, Community Economic Development Specialist at UW Extension and a professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. We're looking at Wisconsin's job market for new graduates of high school and college, and there's still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. If you are an employer, if you're trying to hire people, What are you looking for from recent graduates? Are you ready to provide training lately where maybe you didn't in the past? Recent graduates, what are you looking for from potential employers? How's the job search going? Everybody else, what's your advice for that new grad as they look for a job? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Steve, we're looking mainly at the beginning of careers for people, but one factor in all of this, I'm looking at labor force participation rates lately, still kind of low despite a tight labor market. And what I'm reading is that's the high end, people retiring maybe a couple of few years earlier than they might have. How big a factor is that? Does it trickle down to those people at the beginning of their job careers?
Oh, it does. I can remember when college graduates that were entering the job market were complaining that the baby boomers weren't retiring and they were holding out of these jobs, and these baby boomers, if they just started retiring, they could get it. Well, guess what? Now they're retiring in droves. And what's happening is it's creating this labor shortage, is that we simply do not have enough workers to replace those that are retiring and stepping out. And so it's good. It's good if you're going into the job market, it's good for you. But from the business side of things, it's actually a problem.
And when we look at Wisconsin's demographics, there's more of those baby boomers leaving in some cases. I think I have this right, Steve, than younger people are. The age distribution in Wisconsin is getting older.
That's true across the nation, but Wisconsin does tend to be a little bit older. One of the reasons for that is that we don't have a lot of in-migration of younger folks. There's this discussion about the brain drain that we're losing. We're all our educated people are leaving the state. Actually, the amount of out-migration of educated people is about right on par what you would expect. What Wisconsin is lacking is the in-migration of educated people. So that's creating a little bit of a problem.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in West Allis. Michael, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your story, Michael?
Well, I just actually started working for the city of West Allis, and there's only four of us who initially started, but they were looking to hire at least 20.
Wow.
It feels like, yeah, I know, it's crazy. It feels like they were just looking for more than there is out there. And I've seen a lot of help wanted signs just like you guys have, and there seems like there's a lot more jobs than there are workers. I guess, is there anything that you would suggest to people who don't have jobs, or if they want to upgrade to newer, better paying jobs, what should we do?
Interesting. And Michael, I got to ask, are they working you five times as hard because they only hired 4 out of 20?
Yeah. I mean, we have more than one kind of responsibility under our belt.
Gotcha.
At least the four of us there, but it's not as bad as you think. We do as well as we can. And if we don't finish, then we don't finish.
Gotcha. Michael, thanks a lot for sharing that. And Steve, Michael looking for thoughts, I think on both sides of the equation for job seekers, trying to find those 16 other openings at a place like West Allis. What are your thoughts? Should we be doing our job searching a little differently, given the tight labor market?
I think that a lot of times when companies and local governments are looking for recruitment, sometimes they look in too small of a geographic area. They're looking inside their own community, and they're really not advertising, and they're not looking outside of the area. And that goes back to this kind of commuting conversation that we had before, is that the labor market is really becoming a much larger geographic area. So when you're recruiting, you don't recruit just in the local community. You recruit from a much larger geographic area.
Michael, thanks a lot for that call. Dave joins us now in Toma. Dave, hi.
Yeah, hi. Well, Wisconsin, you know, we enjoy a very diversified economy here. And I think it's just insane that we talk about getting more people to come here. We're a rural state, and that's why people like it here. And this growth concept is not sustainable.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. Dave doesn't want to see our economy try to rely on a constantly growing population, it sounds like, Steve.
That is a very legitimate point. Mm-hmm. In my extension work, I work a lot with rural communities across Wisconsin. And you do oftentimes, when you see a big major development proposed, a lot of times you'll see the community kind of split in half. Half of the community is like, hey, these are good paying jobs. And the other half of the community is like, no, this is too much change. And different communities are going to respond to that in different ways. But you're right. A lot of folks have moved to particularly rural Wisconsin, small-town Wisconsin, or they remain there because they like that kind of an environment. So the question is how can you have your cake and eat it too? How can you create economic opportunities that address, you know, that make for livable wages, for example, but not necessarily changing the dynamics of the community? There are a lot of communities in rural Wisconsin that want to promote tourism and recreation as an economic growth strategy, but then the next thing they say is they don't want to become the next Wisconsin Dells. Mm-hmm. So how can we have our cake and eat it too? And a lot of rural communities, that's what they're struggling with.
Dave, thanks a lot for that call. And on top of that, Steve, can we maintain the level of infrastructure we want? Can we keep a school open in a community with the population trends in rural areas? How big a problem is that for people who want to maintain that lifestyle?
That's becoming a very serious issue. It's partially it's largely driven by the demographics, is that we're simply not having as many kids as we used to have. And you'll see many of these rural school districts that are really kind of falling below critical threshold. And one of the things that I've been following is a lot of schools have to go to referendum because it's the property tax levy limit that's imposed on them. And in order for a lot of these school districts to make the investments that they need to make, they have to go to the taxpayer. And it's really, I find a pattern that's somewhat bothersome, is that the higher income communities tend to pass these. So you end up with investments in schools and you get better schools, whereas lower income communities tend not to pass them. And the schools start to deteriorate. And it's kind of driving a wedge farther between higher income communities and poorer income communities. And what's driving it a lot of times are the schools.
I want to get back to something you said earlier, Steve, about the cost of housing in communities. Now, we don't have, you know, San Francisco's and Seattle's here in Wisconsin, but we have communities where housing costs are going up, Dane County for sure, but other places around the state. How are you seeing local governments, local companies try to deal with the need to have a place to live that their workers can afford?
Interesting. There's a community that we're working with now up in the northern part of the state, up in Ashland County. And they have had several failed searches for elementary school teachers because there's no housing. And it is, you know, they're becoming very frustrated. And I can appreciate that. But housing is a unique issue because there's two things that are going on. One is that a lot of the new housing development tends to be high end. And that's because of the cost of materials and the profit margins. Also, a lot of the developers that were building kind of entry level homes, they were wiped out by the Great Recession and they never came back. So the builders that are out there are going after the higher end. The second thing is that some of the housing is of not very good quality, and we have problems with, lack of a better phrase, slumlords. And state policy right now, unfortunately, really ties the hands of what local municipalities can do when you have landlords that are letting their properties deteriorate. So, one, we don't have a good stock of new starter homes. And secondly, a lot of the homes that we do have are not up to par.
And just our last minute or so, Steve, what is the big trend you're watching for the class of, say, 2024?
Oh, that's a long-term perspective. one of the things I think is that we're probably going to see, as I said, a slowdown in the economy. Businesses are probably not going to be laying off folks in droves, but they may not be hiring. So I think we may be seeing an uptick in the number of students that decide that they want to, you know, continue their education, whether it's technical schools or the university system. What I'll be interested in is, you know, what are they studying? What kind of classes are they taking? Are they taking a liberal arts perspective? Or are they kind of trying to get geared up with technical skills for a very technical job? So I'll be interested in see how that kind of plays out.
Steve, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Steve Deller, UW Extension Community Economic Development Specialist and Professor in Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. He's with us today to talk about the Wisconsin job market and what recent and soon-to-be graduates can expect. You can keep sharing your stories on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, CNN caught some flack for the way it handled a town hall event last week with presidential candidate and former president Donald Trump. We'll talk about the media's role and responsibilities when covering the campaign for the White House. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.